You're listening to the GP Supervision Australia podcast, supporting your registrar to manage the challenging patient, part two. Presented by Dr. Tim Chappell and Dr. Simon Morgan. We would like to begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which this recording was produced and pay our respects to their elders past, present, future, and their families.
This is part two. We've covered a little bit of this, but background factors that contribute to the challenging patient and a framework for use in teaching registrars. But very much we're focusing on strategies both for ourselves as clinicians and for teaching registrars around how to manage these types of encounters, these types of consultations with challenging patients. So it's a great pleasure to hand over to Tim Chappell, who is a GP in Western Australia. Tim's also an SLO with the RACGP and has been an extraordinarily enthusiastic visitor of practices. And if anyone's in the Perth metropolitan area, you may have seen Tim drop in and say hi. But this is an area of interest of his, and it's a great pleasure to have you talk to this topic again, Tim. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Simon. Thank you for having me. I want to proceed. What we mentioned is, you know, you can't please all the people all of the time, even when you try, even when you're trying your hardest. This is really for our registrars who are very earnest and they think we can do it. We can please all the people all the time, but you can't. And we talked about the three different types of challenging patients. There was patient one, which was someone comes in with a symptom and no one knows what to do about it. And they have a normal personality. They're lovely. And they've got this terrible symptom that no one knows what to do. The second challenging person is when everyone knows what to do, but the patient's not doing it. And the third challenging patient is the combination of the first two, where the people have a challenging personality with a problem that no one knows what to do about. And each of those three different types of challenging patients, in my view, have three different approaches. This isn't a kind of a extreme world when you've got extreme patient one, extreme patient two, and extreme patient three. Of course, in the real world, everything's much more complex, and some of this advice can apply to one section and not to another. So just take that for what it is. Much of the research done on this topic, it can be helpful, but it can also, I have to acknowledge that there is some skepticism on my part because human beings are so complex. It is very, very hard to do research on this sort of area. Well, it's harder than doing research on antibiotics, for instance. It's just harder. You can do it, and there's some good stuff out there, but it's just harder, and I'm a little bit skeptical of some of it. Anyway, what this is just my homespun advice about what to do, survival techniques for registrars of the different types of challenging patients. Extreme patient one, that is the patient with, normal personality who has a problem, there's no clear diagnosis, and no one knows what to do about it. So these are the sort of people who have ongoing headaches, who have chest pain, they've got vertigo or dizziness, they've seen the specialist, they've done everything, and they've still got the problem, and they come to you and say, it's my headaches. And that can be a little bit of a heart sink for a lot of us, certainly it is for me, where you want to help people and to do what you can. When it happens again and again, they come in and no progress is made, it can be very distressing to the point that you kind of don't want to see them anymore because you've got nothing to give. You feel like you've got nothing to give anyway. Yeah, you've seen them many times already. You've seen sometimes many specialists, sometimes, and they still have the problem. So I've got two illustrative points of this one, just anecdotal points. There's one guy who saw me, he was a retired shearer, arms like Popeye. Tough guy, but very straight shooter, lovely fellow. We got on really well, and he came in with what I thought had carpal tunnel syndrome in his hands. And indeed, the EMG said it was carpal tunnel, so off he went to the plastic surgeon and had the surgery done. He said he was much better, everything was good for a while. Then he came back and said his hands were tingling again, and the surgery hadn't worked. So at that time, this is some years ago now, probably wouldn't have done it now, I sent him back to the surgeon. The surgeon did another EMG and said, no, everything's fine. Everything's fine. Well, everything wasn't fine because he still had the symptoms. And then they started going in his legs and his feet. And I thought, well, he's got diabetes. This is probably peripheral neuropathy. The trouble was it was just getting worse and worse and worse. And we're focusing on his diabetes, really whipping him to get his diabetes better. And he started to develop weakness And I was starting to get a bit sweaty here, and so was he, because he found it hard to walk. And we did MRI scans of his thoracic spine and his lumbar spine. Clinical examination, which I went through with a fine toothpick, showed nothing except weakness in his legs. And I sent him off to the urologist, and the urologist sent back and said, look, it's pretty extreme, but we can only conclude that it's the diabetes that's doing it. And so he comes in with a wide base gait, hardly able to get out of his chair. And I say he says, he's relating to me what the specialist said. And he starts crying. This tough shearer starts crying, saying, it's not the diabetes. It's not the diabetes. And, you know, if I was honest, I kind of wanted to run out the room because I didn't know what to do. So that's the sort of patient I'm talking about. And the other one, much, much briefer story, is a 45-year-old woman with an acquired head injury who was becoming extremely violent, and her carers found it almost impossible to look after her. She would kick people. She would smash a TV. They'd find a shoe in the television set. She was paraplegic, so it meant that she couldn't chase people around, but people were frightened to approach her. The family were lovely. The parents were devoted to their daughter. And they kept coming back and back with the problem, and it was becoming more and more intense, and it was becoming really alarming. So that's the sort of problem that I'm talking about. Certainly things may be getting worse. I've got two aspects of this. I've got general advice, and I've got advice for the consultation. So the general advice is this. Don't give up on them. You know, I think I had to talk to myself in these situations when it happens. In this situation, this is a challenge where you start becoming a real doctor. That's what I describe it, a real physician. And this is the time not to give up on them. If they don't fit the algorithms that we've all been taught, extricate yourself from a challenging patient. But it is not helpful to say, I cannot help you with this problem. I think that is the purview of the specialist, but not of the general practitioner. Because the general practitioner is caring for the person. The cardiologist looks after the heart. Yes, they can look after the person. And I know some wonderful cardiologists. This is not an anti-specialist talk, but it's just not in the purview of the general practitioner to say, I can't help with this problem. It may be you could say that the relationship is broken down, but we'll talk about that a little bit later. But to say, I can't help you with this problem is not really the luxury that a general practitioner has, in my opinion. That's what I think. That's what I say to registrars. And I urge you to say it to your registrars. Have some degree of confidence that the solution will come up and that you will be involved in finding it. I urge registrars to take the reins and be a doctor and look for the solution. They're not mad. How many times have we read reports in the newspaper of people with serious illnesses, and all the time doctors have been told that they were mad, or there's some history of some disease where people thought the doctors were kept saying they're mad. It is my own personal experience, and it seems to match with a lot of specialists from the hospitals, that almost everyone who comes in with a very distressing symptom has something. They have some pathology. It's very, very unusual for me to see malingerers or anything of that nature. And I've got a few anecdotes again to say about how I thought someone was mad when they had a serious, serious pathology. A regular standing appointment can be really helpful for these people. So that is, when it's recognized that we're not getting anywhere, instead of kind of saying, I can't help you, it is much better to book either a weekly appointment or a monthly appointment. For the lady with the acquired head injury, we made a 6-weekly regular standing appointment for a long appointment to see how we were going. So that can be really helpful. What it does, it means that the patient has some, they know it's coming. They know the appointment's coming. They don't have to fight for it. They don't have to feel guilty that I'm going to have to see the doctor again. And it doesn't become an issue in itself. And it's helpful for the doctor because then they know that this week you might be free of them. You might have a bit of a break from them for this week. So it's a regular standing point can be very helpful. I encourage registrars to do a bit of research. My goodness, we've got the greatest research engine in the whole world, the internet, which is amazing. And you can sometimes find the answer that you might be looking for in 2 minutes or less, 90 seconds. There is a pressure, and maybe it comes from the hospitals, that something needs to be resolved in one consultation, but nothing needs to be resolved in one consultation. Certainly things need to be achieved of some nature, which we'll get on to in a sec, but we don't need closure. We don't need complete closure and kind of we can fix this up. This is the beauty of general practice, that things can continue on and we work towards a good outcome. Specialists are often right. Again, don't get me wrong, I've known some wonderful specialists. There are some wonderful specialists out there, marvelous doctors. But no one's 100%. And general practice has a secret weapon, what is our superpower. And it is that we often know the patients really well and the specialists don't. And that gives us a real advantage in trying to nut out what's going on. Having said that, you know, specialists are the ones I send to are tremendous and they're often right, but nothing's 100%. Nothing's 100%. So generally speaking, for these sorts of people, emotional support is what is required. That's what's required, emotional support, that you're with them, despite them complaining about the medical profession, despite them complaining about you, perhaps, they still need emotional support. And that is what is really required. When I say emotional support, I'm not exactly talking about handholding, but that you're behind them and that you'll keep trying, that you're in their camp, you're in their corner, fighting for them. So in the consultation, this is what I say to registrars, that the answer is in the history and using logic. Even though everyone nods at this, no one seems to do it, and I include myself in this. I try and explain it to the patient that we're not asking you the right questions. That's what the issue is often. Often the issue is the doctor not asking the right questions. To use an illustration of this, when I was in hospital, sometimes it just used to astonish me that we'd have someone we didn't know what was going on and the wise consultant would come in and just ask just the right question and the answer would come pouring out. Now, that was years and years of experience being shown there, but there's power in the right questions. So I recommend people to go over the history again and again with a fine tooth comb because there's something there. There's something there that will help us. It really is the answers in the history and not so much in blood tests. I find registrars have a great penchant for doing blood tests and thinking the answers hopefully somehow magically going to come up in blood tests. The same applies to imaging, though imaging, the answer comes up more readily than blood tests, but the same applies. I think I've got nothing against doing tests, don't get me wrong, but I think that we should be thinking, why are we doing the tests? If we're doing the tests just to do something, just to finish the consultation so we give them a piece of paper, that's going to backfire. I found many registrars are quite timid about giving empirical therapy. And when I say empirical therapy, I'm not talking about wacky therapy or therapy that's not mainstream. I'm talking about giving mainstream therapy. You think this is going on, why don't you treat it? Because many times I've had to encourage registrars, and I urge you as supervisors to encourage your registrars to have a crack. Often in this situation, there isn't a lot to lose. It might be worthwhile giving that antibiotic or giving that anti-inflammatory or even to the point starting methotrexate or something like that. That's fairly big, but yeah, don't be afraid of giving empirical therapy. And of course, be honest. The honesty has to be house trained. It's not helpful to the patient to blurt out and say, I don't know what to do. Sometimes it is, but often it's not. So the honesty has to be house trained and has to be professional, but we do need to be honest and articulate in that honesty, just to explain exactly what we think might be going on and what we're trying to achieve. And what we can't achieve, by all means, we can say that we don't know what's going on, but it has to be couched in a certain tone, a certain way of that we're in there. Rather than panicking, we're behind them. We're with them. We're going to go into patient two yet, but that guy who we thought had peripheral neuropathy and saw the neurologist, I phoned up his son who was paying for all the MRI scans, and I realized just going through everything, going through the history and logic, I realized we hadn't, even though he didn't have upper motor neuron signs, and the neurologist agreed he didn't have upper motor neuron signs, we got an MRI scan of his neck because I neglected to do his cervical spine, something that just passed me by. I didn't want to spend all this money, you know. But by that stage, it was irrelevant. The money was irrelevant. Anyway, came back with one of these huge turnip-sized osteophytes that was pressing on his spinal cord. And he had a few millimeters left before his spinal cord was disconnected. So we found the cause. And sent him off immediately to the neurosurgeon, who, by some miraculous circumstances, found that there were upper motor neuron signs in the examination. It's amazing what you can find when you know the diagnosis already. And so that was a win in the end, but it took a long time to get there. The second lady, again, we went through everything with a fine tooth pick. What happened to make her go so aggressive, and why was she so severe? And it was getting particularly stressful. They'd been to see the neurologist, they'd been to see a psychiatrist. Nothing was really being changed. People were giving her more diazepam. They're basically pushing off to sleep. And we went through everything. And then I think it was the COVID vaccine that might have done it, the Pfizer vaccine. But she, at the very, very start of all this, she had some neurological symptoms. And I thought this could be an ongoing urinary tract infection. So we tried empirical therapy with antibiotics. And lo and behold, miracle upon miracles, it actually came good. And in the end, we gave her long-term antibiotics, which was tremendously successful. And it was a great relief because I was losing a little bit of sleep over her. Anyway, sorry, Simon, go ahead.
I guess just a couple of things from what you've said. One, the power of the story, the power of the anecdote. And I think in the sort of busyness of general practice and general practice training, often, you know, we dispense with a story like you've just told us and try to give some advice to registrars about management. But I think there's so much power and value in hearing those sort of war stories. I guess an encouragement to do that. You talked about how much is too much pathology and imaging ordering, and that is a really tricky thing for registrars. But I guess my take on that would be it's very reasonable to do the basics and maybe, you know, the second tier. But I think if a registrar is thinking about, you know, more sophisticated, expensive, certainly invasive testing, perhaps they really should be talking to a supervisor who may be able to say, look, there's going to be little value in that, or that would be a kind of threshold for me.
Totally agree, particularly about the expense. Without actually talking to them, like, long story, but I watched House recently because we got hooked onto Amazon and watched series of House. So it was appalled. I mean, in one episode, one of the hospital administrators saying, he's the best damn doctor we've got in this hospital. He's the worst. He doesn't talk to people. It's all in the history, House. It's all in the history. It's not in the tests.
I have said that my son, who's now an intern, was motivated to do medicine, having watched a couple of episodes of House. So there you go. I hope he doesn't turn out the same. Lastly, you've talked about two patients who had curable, or at least, sorry, identifiable conditions. But so many of these patients, actually, we don't end up with something. I think all those messages, obviously, again, for a registrar, so important. It may be that even with really good history and empirical therapy and, you know, the right number of tests, we don't find anything. But validating, as was said, the reassurance is sometimes better than nothing, and something just being with them can help. And I think that's something registrars don't kind of get. They just want to make the diagnosis and make it fixed rather than just walk beside them through this journey.
The consultation could be therapeutic. That's been said time and time again down through the ages by doctors, that the consultation itself can be therapeutic and can be a help to people. Patient two. So these are the patients that I describe a difficult personality with or without a problem or symptom. Everyone knows what should be done, but they're not doing it. So I don't want to dwell on this too much, but there are many different types of personalities. It's helpful for doctors to be familiar with them. These are the people who make unreasonable demands, outrageous demands, sometimes very immature people. Even if they're aged, they could still be immature in their personalities. And many of these people that we see who make unreasonable demands or we feel like a personality disorders are often damaged people. And the people that I've had over the many years, many of them have been damaged. So there's reasons why they're like this. And I wouldn't ever want to kind of blame them for their behavior. Their behavior might still be unreasonable, but it's helpful to keep them in the back of their mind that often that's their survival techniques for life because they've been so damaged. Borderlines, of course, 50% of personality disorders to go to general practice are borderlines that crave a special relationship with the doctor that champions its splitting. I mentioned the story of Joan, who every single time she came in, tried to split me against someone. So it's just you and the patient against everyone else. And they can make you think that if you don't act now, then everything's going to be disastrous. It's going to be the end of the world. You're either with me or against me. They can draw a line in the sand. Are you going to do this or are you not, doctor? Well, of course, anything against me is anything the patients don't like. You have to kind of basically follow their agenda. The antisocials were surprised to me after doing a bit of psych and then going out into the big bad world in general practice. I didn't realize how often charming they can be and how much fun they can be to see. But you get into trouble with the antisocials, as most people do. Just be on the lookout for phrases like, I don't understand it. Trouble follows me wherever I go, doctor. Oh, I don't understand it. Or, I guess this is a bit of a giveaway, it was all a big mistake. I was never meant to rob the bank. Someone said that to me a few years ago. He said, I was never meant to be holding the shotgun. I found that the antisocial personality disorders are easier than the borderlines because they often respect principles in others, even if they try to push them. So I've often found with the antisocials that if you say this is you're crossing a moral line, I can't do this, they're quite respectful if you show the moral side to things. For example, I had this one guy, Irascible Scott. He came in and he had a voice like Sean Connery. He didn't look like Sean Connery, but his voice was marvelous. And he said to me that he wanted me to sign these forms so the government would subsidize his electricity bill because he had a neurological condition. And I said, what is your neurological condition? I've got peripheral neuropathy. That's what I have, peripheral neuropathy. I said, well, unfortunately, that's not the condition. It's neurological, he said. I said, well, mate, just look at this list of things here. If you could find one on that list, then I could sign you off. He looked and said, just sign the bloody thing, which was surprisingly intimidating, particularly as that was about 25 years ago. As a more junior, I felt myself trembling a little bit, thinking I painted myself into a corner until I realized I just didn't have to do it at all. I just burst out laughing and said, no, mate, I can't. And he totally backed down. So that's what I found with the antisocials. So the advice of patient two, you can only have so many patients, I'm going to say later, you can only have so many challenging patients. And I think you have to decide if you want to see them, if you want to take them on, or it is possible to do a dance and say that you're either full or something like that. You just have to decide if you want to see them. This is a quote from a psychiatrist friend of mine who said, you don't have to like your PDs, but you do have to love them. And that sounds like an oxymoron, doesn't it? But it's actually, you do have to actually love them. You know, you see a part that you think you can look forward to seeing them, and you wonder how they're going. I think for these patients, it's really helpful to make a regular long appointment. This is what I did with Joan. I made a regular long appointment. I saw it every month. These types of patients, it's damage control. And GPs can do a tremendous service, not just to the patient, but to the whole community by being involved with these patients. And I find it sometimes helpful to inform them of the plan. Joan, you know something? You see me quite regularly. Why don't we formalize this? Well, I want you to make a regular long appointment to see me. You know, and also, and you can ask them, what do you think would be the distance between the time interval? Month, 6 weeks, sometimes weekly for a short period of time. This is a controversial one. I can do this at my practice because we're a private practice. I broke my own rules here. In general practice, never say always. I always charge them. But having said that, I didn't charge Joan. So I broke my own rules, because I want to be upfront with everyone. I knew Joan couldn't afford me. And I knew that by that stage, we'd had developed quite a relationship. When we went private, I kept seeing her. But generally speaking, it makes so much difference to you, the doctor, and to the patient if you charge them. So I urge you, except for those exceptional cases, to always charge them. They'll try and push the boundaries to you on that, but always, always charge them. And I've always found it also really helpful because they get quite filled with anxiety when you're on leave. I always tell them that I'm on leave and that I'm not going to be available for a certain period of time. That's a surprisingly helpful thing to tell them at the consult if you know that you're going to be on leave for the next few weeks. Very helpful thing. They really do appreciate it. So resist the temptation to try to discipline them when they're there. Challenging personalities can make doctors, they can make me enraged, and I wanted to discipline them. It's not helpful. It's not helpful. It's much better to let it go. It's not our job to do that. I think it's not really helpful to express your anger. Though very occasionally, again, never say always, very occasionally it can be. I had one patient who was, I think he was disappointed that he couldn't have joined the SS. like he was the closest thing to a high-ranking Nazi official that I've ever met, and I'm not joking. And I kept him waiting just only for 5 minutes in the back of our treatment area. Next thing I come back and he's going through all the cupboards, looking through all the cupboards. That is highly inappropriate, like he's pilfering, highly inappropriate behavior. And that's the time to raise one's voice and say, that's just not on. It's not on. Resist the temptation to relax your boundaries. Sometimes in their charm and you feel like you're winning and things are going well, you can think, yeah, I think I relaxed my boundaries. No, don't relax your boundaries. Just keep it firm. So the boundaries, they're quite variable because patients have often different needs and they push the buttons in different areas. Timing is a big one, but they need to be clear in your own mind. So when I say timing, some patients will take way too long and expect too much of the doctor's time. One patient, I just put my phone up to him and just started the stopwatch and just put it down in front of us saying, when that reaches 30 minutes, that's the end of the consultation. Then we argued 10 minutes about why we should do that. So we've already wasted 10 minutes, mate. But they have to be reasonable. They have to be clearly reasonable. Like sometimes I've done what I've felt like was unreasonable, kind of what I wanted to punish the patient at the time. So I've let that all go. And they have to be reasonable and apply to just about everyone. Definitely no splitting. Never engage in that sort of behavior. So when Joan kept saying, you know, the hospital doctors thought I was really bad, sometimes I would phone up the hospital doctors and say, look, you know, we're good friends. So I try to really discourage splitting. There's no offensive behavior from patients. That's generally speaking, we all know what offensive behavior is, and that's just not on. I think it's quite within the doctor's right to say, you're not coming to see me again if you're going to behave like that. We had one patient who threatened death to the reception staff that really frightened them. He'd done it a number of times and I said, that's it, you're not seeing us anymore. So any offensive behavior that scares the staff, or scares the doctor, scares the registrar, you know, needs to be addressed. I've had one registrar particularly who hugged. No, I agree with Bernard. Offensive language also, I don't put up with that, particularly when it's at staff as well, particularly against staff, and particularly when it's meant to be offensive. Some people's language, it's not meant to be offensive, and I can let it slip to the keeper, but when it's meant to be offensive, that's not on. So no hugging, okay? Do I have to dwell on this one? But I had one registrar who hugged at the end of every patient. It's crossing a boundary. It's going to get you into major trouble. But anything of that nature, that personal nature where you think it's really going to help, it's not going to help. It's not going to help. Just don't do it. I would give minimal personal information out. Not that you'd need to be too paranoid about this, but many of my PDs, they would love to know so much personal information. They often keep asking me about, you know, how's my wife, how are my kids, all that sort of stuff. And we spend a lot of time talking about me. I try and discourage it. We're not here to talk about me. We're here to try and address some medical problems. Yes, so keep focused on the medical. You're a doctor, they're a patient. Let's do this. What are you here for? So during the consultation, I urge people to smile. When I say smile, I don't mean the nervous kind of grin that someone might have, or the smile of insouciance, or the patronizing smile. I mean a genuine smile that you're pleased to see them. It makes the world of difference, I discovered. You know, that would be interesting to do some research onto that to see what smiling makes a difference to the consultation. It makes the patient a lot more relaxed instead of frowning. So when Scott said that to me, I burst out laughing, I smiled. It changed the whole consultation. He said, well, everyone's getting it. I said, well, no, that's just not true. Everyone in his street was getting it. So he'd go to those doctors, not to me. So smile. I would stick to facts. Many of these patients are tremendously giving smoke screens and going off tangents and going all over the place. Just stick to facts. Very helpful. I describe this as that science is your friend in this situation. It can really help you. I found many registrars, this is hard to describe, but they don't seem to get this, that science can be really helpful and they can rely upon it, because many of these challenging patients can disagree with you or trip you up, use a smoke screen. But if you get back to science, it can be really helpful. For example, one guy who put the workers' comp for 2 years and he had ankle pain. And he said, and no one knows what's going on with me. No one knows. I just got this chronic, terrible pain. But I said, well, mate, I think got an anterior talar fibular ligament injury. And he said, that's it. Yeah, that's it. That's the thing it is. I said, that's a sprained ankle, mate. That's a sprained ankle. So the question is, why is someone with a sprained ankle had chronic pain for 2 years? Which, of course, we all know they can do. It's possible. But he was left wondering for a while. That's what I mean by science being a friend. If there is a symptom, then we need to get the diagnosis. It's very important to get the diagnosis to know exactly what you're dealing with, because the smoke screen can lead you down all over the place. And sometimes going back over my notes, I just shake my head thinking, where was I going with this patient? So get the diagnosis, very helpful. Smile and laugh. I found it really helpful to be positive and to engage with people and to really enjoy it if you can. It's a great challenge.
I wanted to ask you two things, and so if you could respond to this briefly, it would be great. Firstly, do you have any tips about how registrars can maintain boundaries when they're feeling pretty vulnerable, they don't have confidence, these patients are often quite manipulative in the way they talk to them, how to support that? And I guess the other thing is, do we or should we or should our registrars ever, you know, make a diagnosis, a positive diagnosis of a personality disorder? Talk to the patient about that? Is it just sort of in the background? It's hush hush. It's just, we know it, but it's never explicit.
The answer to the first question is really talking about these patients with the registrar.
Yep.
Just being open talk, making sure that they realize that they're not alone, that this happens to everyone, to every doctor, but there is a way forward and it is okay to say no. It's okay to say no and to say no nicely. And to say no in an encouraging way, not in a kind of terrified way, but in a way saying, no, I can't. The more they registrars understand that, I think the happier life is for them. And I feel that that's what we should be teaching them in med school, actually, how to say no nicely, politely, because I feel some of the registrars I've had to paint themselves into a corner and just out of sheer being trapped, a feeling of being trapped, something kind of almost appeared rude in the way they said
yeah,
no. Bernard Chapman has said that, I'm sorry, but I'm a bit blunt with some of my personality disorders. I think it can be really blunt if you say it with a smile. I think you can be really blunt. In fact, the sooner you say no, the better. You know, when someone says, I want my Xanax, I say, no, mate, no. Why not? Just no. I haven't given Xanax for years, and you know that. And you know what that guy said? He said, well, I'm just trying my luck. Right. Yeah, good one. Yeah. Patient three, I've got this concept of running towards the wave because you can see a big disaster approaching. And if you're surfing or you're out in the ocean and you see a big wave coming towards you, the temptation is to run away from the wave. But of course, that's worse. It's much better to run towards the wave and dive through it. And that way you can get away scot-free. If you run away from the wave, it often crashes over you and you get caught up in all the whitewash. So the same applies to patients. Run towards the wave. Patient three. This is a patient with a difficult personality who has a symptom that no one knows what to do. You need to recognize this is a problem and decide to take them on. So if you want to take them on, I'd make a regular booking with the patient, a long appointment, often weekly, if there's got a significant symptom and you want to figure out what's going on. Stick to facts and make sure something is achieved in the consultation. I just find it helpful to think that if people look back on what you were doing, what was actually achieved at that consultation is a helpful way of thinking about it. And I found registrar quite helpful too. You do one thing at a time. You don't have the patient's problem. Boundaries are very important with patient three. Very, very important because you can go right off the rails. But don't give up on them because it can be very rewarding. Basically, what we do is we combine the advice from patient one and two and bring it all together. So just refresh your memories. A regular standing point can be helpful. Be prepared to research. Nothing needs to be resolved in one consultation. Specialists are often right, but nothing is 100%. Emotional support as well is required, that you're behind them and that you'll keep trying. And in the consultation, you need to smile where appropriate. Stick to facts. Science is your friend and get the diagnosis. And smile and laugh. After the consultation, speak about the patient as if they're with you in the room. This is so important. Just so important because I've seen many doctors come unstuck when they're telling stories outside and it gets back to the patient. So do remember that. It can save you a heap of trouble. There's just a few examples that I want to give you. One lady who I've described patient three. She came in just to see what sort of patient she was like. I was explaining to her about warfarin and saying how, you know, paracetamol can kill rats, but warfarin, you know, she was saying it's rat poison. I said, anything can kill a rat. Any medication can kill a rat. Paracetamol can kill a rat. But with warfarin, the rats eat the warfarin and then they get thirsty because they bleed into their bowel and they leave the house to look for water and they die outside. That's why it's such a great rat poison. And she said, oh, that explains why I found a dead rat outside of my driveway. I said, maybe. Maybe it was warfarin. I said, yeah. I put it in my neighbor's letterbox. You what? I said. I put it in my neighbor's letterbox. She's such a bitch. She said, I said, you realize that person's just having nightmares about you put a rat in a letterbox. I don't care, she said. Anyway, she came to me one day a few years prior to that and said, I'm so short of breath. I can't even get to the letterbox. I can't even get the letterbox without, I feel like I'm dying. And she's such a drama queen. And I thought, oh, okay. And I've thought about this talk that I give to registrars. I thought, stop. This is patient three. Go through it. Believe the patient. Go and do, what would you do? So we had an examination. Nothing was coming up. Went through the history. It was challenging. In the end, I thought, well, what would you do in an inverted commas normal person? Well, I'll give an echo and a cardiogram. So the next thing I heard, she was, after getting the echo, she was having an emergency transport to St. Charles Gardner Hospital for cardiac surgery because she had a pinhole in her mitral valve from undiagnosed rheumatic heart disease, and she was almost about to expire. I thought, phew, that's why she's on warfarin now. It's because you've got a valve replacement. She will need some rat poison. She's taking it as we speak. Yeah, before we can say we're going to have so many challenging patients, I do want to say that it's actually very rewarding, embracing, running towards the wave is perhaps I've found the most rewarding part of being a general practitioner, taking on some of these problems. You don't solve them all and you can get burned, but it can be very rewarding. Every true general practitioner has a lot of challenging patients. So I do want to say that it's very rewarding, though. You know, I told the story of Joan, the one who kept splitting, the one who I bolt billed eventually. Eventually, she stopped seeing me for a while because she was too unwell to come and see me. She's only late 50s. She ended up in ICU and in a hospital ICU. And I didn't know about this, but what I learned was the registrar phoned me up and said, we've got this lady here. And she said, she's dying, you know, she's dying. She was in ICU. Anyway, The point was that they're going to stop her medication, which they said, but it's quite extraordinary. She was an English doctor, quite extraordinary. She wants to speak to you. I've never heard of this happening. She wants to speak to a general practitioner. Doesn't even want to speak to her family. She wants to speak to you. So I said, sure, put her on. So she was electing to have this dobutamine. I'm sure it was dobutamine. Yeah, she was electing to have this stop, and they said that she would die if they stopped it. I said, Joan, are you sure you want to do this? Oh, yeah, Tim. She said, I've had enough. I've had enough, Tim. I can't go on. I said, Joan, wait, stop. Stop. Think about this. Think about it. This is... You got life. Maybe, you know, they've said to you that they could stop it, but maybe they shouldn't stop it. Maybe you should go on for a few more hours and see how you go. No, Tim, she said, I had enough. But forget all that, she said, Tim, in a clute, characteristic style. The reason what I want to phone you up about is that I just want to thank you, Tim. I want to thank you. You've been very good to me. I've given you a hard time. But you've been very good. So I just want to thank you for that. And we had a chat for about kind of 5 minutes after that. I put the phone down, then got 2 hours later, from the registrar saying she'd passed away. And I don't think I really helped her that much insofar as kind of a medical time. Like, didn't help her lose weight, tried very hard to help with her diabetes, tried, you know, to help with all her multiplicity of problems. We didn't get very far there, but she never really gave me this impression that she was appreciating what I was trying to do. But, you know, there are patients out there who really do appreciate it. They look back and they're very, very grateful. I found it very rewarding in that respect. Please don't beat yourself up for being manipulated or getting up in the patient's web. It happens to the best of us that patients get under our skin and it really goes pear-shaped. Paul Simon said there are 50 ways to leave your lover. There are about 1,000 ways to leave a patient. So it's very straightforward, actually. Sometimes we are the only people who listen to them and the only people who touch them.
I'm actually really pleased, Tim, to have put references at the end because it's almost, as you said at the outset, putting formal written evidence-based approaches to some of these things is kind of okay, but hearing a story like yours at the end of this session is, a thousand times more powerful and useful for a registrar than reading a journal article. Obviously, they may choose to do that, but it's sort of juxtaposed nicely with what you've just said, that, yes, there's some reading, yes, the registrar may choose to go off and read some strategies, but I think the sorts of things you've covered, I can see why this talk has been, over the years, something your registrars have responded to. And I'm guessing that's not the first time you've told that story, because it's so powerful and speaks to our role as GPs far beyond our capacity to make a diagnosis or institute the right therapy or, those things that registrars often think are the most important.
It's interesting because I started giving this talk while I was still seeing Joan. So I gave this talk to registrars and then she passed away over the years of giving this talk.
I'm very conscious when we run sessions like this that supervisors as GPs, as clinicians come along because we want to be better doctors ourselves, but we also wish to inspire our registrars to be the best they can too. So I think there's kind of two elements to it. So I'm really hoping people have taken a lot from this, what is really a very simple schema around how patients may challenge us in the consultation and how we can institute some very, I think, very, very patient-centered approaches to better manage them.
As general practitioners, it's a tremendous privilege. We should enjoy it. It's a wonderful job, a wonderful job.
And Tim, just a final thank you very, very much for sharing your wisdom. And I think this truly is your wisdom. This is not, I mean, I know you've read around the topic, but this is very much a distillation of your experience and your thinking. And thank you so much for sharing it.
Oh, great pleasure. Thank you for inviting me. Really appreciate it. Thanks, Simon.
Thanks for listening. We'd love your feedback. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please give us a rating and or a review. And if you haven't already, please subscribe and share this podcast with your colleagues. If you'd like to ask a question or suggest a topic, you can reach out to us via our social channels. Simply search GP Supervision Australia on Facebook, Instagram or X, formerly Twitter. GP Supervision Australia is supported by funding from the Australian Government under the Australian General Practice Training Program.